Nuclear Armageddon, the trade show. Once a year, those whose business is the manufacture, promotion, and justification of nuclear weapons gather in Washington, D.C. for the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, a three-day extravaganza that combines a conference, trade show, networking opportunity, meet and greets, and unofficial lobbying for funds to bolster their justifications for being leaders in the destructions of the planet. It's a one-up, glad-handing, ego-driven bragathon of nukesters and their financial overlords in the government, who take the opportunity to clap each other on their backs and celebrate, well, whatever it is they've got to celebrate. But sometimes, even at an event like this, there's a voice in the wilderness, a brave, contrary individual and experienced campaigner against nuclear weapons who has the chutzpah to attend and the footnotes to back up his positions. And he reports back to the rest of us that...
And to hear pretty much from many of the most senior speakers, enormous ignorance about the state of the world. So these are people who get intelligence briefings. I mean, General Cotton at Stratcom. He doesn't understand recent history. He doesn't understand anything about U.S.-Russian relations, about the war in Ukraine. They're all looking at this through a very blinkered and warped perspective that precludes arms control and disarmament.
Well, when Greg Mello, founder and executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, puts a big heart and a critical eye on the nuclear weapons echo chamber in D.C., you get yet another perspective on what bucks up and promotes for profit that deadly, awful, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a fascinating interview with Greg Mello, executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group. Greg recently returned from a three-day visit to the Belly of the Beast, the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit in Washington, D.C., where those responsible for our nuclear future gather to network, learn the latest in self-justification for what they do, and put their dibbies on massive amounts, billions of dollars, in taxpayer monies. It is a jaw-dropping report. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, a new feature, the ICAN update on the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons work to implement the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. And you will also get more honest nuclear information than Jon Stewart has yet addressed in his return to the daily shows. But it's still early days, and we're hopeful. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, February 27, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Here in the U.S., Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri has vowed to attach the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act to anything moving on the Senate floor. The amendment will reauthorize and expand a law compensating Americans exposed to radiation by the federal government and expand coverage to include New Mexico, Missouri, Idaho, Montana, Guam, Colorado, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Alaska. In a statement, Hawley wrote, "Our reauthorization bill passed the Senate last summer with a strong bipartisan vote. Now we must finish the job. There are RECA claimants in every state, including each of yours. They will benefit if this bill is passed. Simply put, it's the right thing to do." Our feature on recent Rika actions, including Senator Hawley's, are featured on Nuclear Hot Seat number 660 from February 14, 2024. In Massachusetts, Holtec International, the company that owns the shuttered Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station, has so far not received permission to pursue its initial plan to discharge 1.1 million gallons of radioactive wastewater into Cape Cod Bay. But while it awaits decisions by state and federal regulators, the company has gotten rid of some 200,000 gallons of that radioactive wastewater by placing submerged heaters in the reactor cavity and evaporating it. Now, the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection has ordered Holtec to calculate and submit an analysis of the potential emission of contaminants known to be in the plant's wastewater based on a sampling taken last April. The company has said that the evaporation has been incidental to heating the water to keep the building warm for workers. Meanwhile, Holtec's radioactive wastewater problem is quickly vanishing through the reactor building's unfiltered vents into the surrounding community, and ultimately ending up in Cape Cod Bay, carried by prevailing wind and falling in the form of precipitation. And on a Tennessee interstate, a truckload of low-level radioactive waste caught fire. We'll link to a video on that on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 662. And the Nuclear Regulatory Commission has cited the Palo Verde nuclear plant in Arizona for a 2023 incident in which a stray pellet from an air rifle used for pigeon control damaged a main turbine control valve signal cable and caused a partial load reject. I don't know what any of that means, but it was really expensive. In Japan, the big story is how Takashi Ebisawa, believed to be a leader within the organized crime syndicate Yakuza, has been charged with conspiring to traffic nuclear substances from Myanmar to other countries, with the expectation that Iran would eventually use them for its weapons program. The charges are conspiring to sell weapons-grade nuclear material and lethal narcotics, and military weaponry was part of the arms deal and included surface-to-air missiles. A group of Indonesian environmental and human rights activists have filed a lawsuit against Japan, demanding an end to the release of radioactive water from the Fukushima nuclear power plant into the Pacific Ocean. They suspect that seafood caught in Indonesia's waters and those imported from Japan have been contaminated with radioactive substances. And after the Japanese government did not respond to their complaints that they had submitted through the Japanese embassy in Jakarta, they decided to take the case to court. Also regarding that radioactive water release, a Kyoto News survey found that more than 80% of prefectural fisheries cooperative associations were affected by the discharge of radioactive water, including financial damage due to the import ban imposed by China, which will accept no fish or seafood from Japan at all. In Ukraine, a string of powerful explosions occurred near Ukraine's Russian-controlled Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. This included an unusually loud one, indicating very close proximity to the site. There was no direct shelling of the plant, nor is there any known damage to it at this time. Following a warning by the U.S. over Russia's intention to deploy a nuclear anti-satellite weapon in space, China has come out opposing any arms race in space. In Russia, taking a page out of the billionaire bros launching themselves into space on their personally owned rockets, Russian President Vladimir Putin undertook a test flight on the new nuclear-capable strategic bomber. Putin's 30-minute flight seemed intended to send a reminder of Russia's nuclear might amid soaring tensions with the West over the fighting in Ukraine. This week, we are pleased to present a new feature, monthly reports from ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Here's Alistair Burnett, ICAN's head of media, coming to us from ICAN's Geneva, Switzerland headquarters, with his update on the campaign to get the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, or TPNW, enforced as international law.
Hello, I'm Alistair Burnett, and I'm the head of media for ICAN, with the first of our monthly news updates from the campaign. One of the main focuses of ICAN's work is to encourage countries to sign and ratify the Nuclear Ban Treaty, the TPNW. So far in 2024, the African island state of Sao Tome e Principe became the 70th country to ratify the treaty. There are about 140 countries in the United Nations General Assembly that have voted to support the TPNW in annual votes, and so we're working on persuading all of them to take the next step and join the treaty. It takes time, but we think that 70 ratifications and another 27 signatures is good going only 3 years after the treaty came into force. Our executive director, Melissa Park, who you heard on a recent edition of Nuclear Hot Seat, visited Hiroshima and Nagasaki last month, where she was able to meet Hibakusha and pay her respects to those who were killed in the atomic bombings or their aftermath. Melissa also met politicians and spoke to a lot of media, as well as an advisor to the Prime Minister, urging Mr. Kishida, whose family come from Hiroshima and who says he's personally committed to disarmament, to listen to Japanese public opinion, stand up to the United States and join the TPNW. She said Japan has the moral authority and responsibility as the only country to be attacked with nuclear weapons to lead on getting rid of them, as its actions would help encourage other countries that may be holding back on signing the TPNW. We've also been planning our activities for the year, and we're thinking about how we can turn NATO's 75th anniversary summit in Washington, D.C. in July to the advantage of the campaign. We want to call out deterrence and the basing of American nuclear weapons in Europe. Finally, we have a week of action plan to encourage more divestment from companies that produce nuclear weapons. The call, No More Money for Nuclear Weapons, will be in the week commencing 17th of June. It will follow the publication of ICANN's annual report on how much the nuclear-armed states have spent on nuclear weapons in the previous year. One of the authors of that report is Susie Snyder, ICANN's program coordinator, who's also one of the co-authors of another big report related to the financing of nuclear weapons that's just come out. It's called Untenable Investments, and it's from the Don't Bank on the Bomb project. You can find it at www.don'tbankonthebomb.com. I've been talking to Susie about that report and the work campaigning for the financial sector to divest from nuclear weapons. Hi, Susie. You're one of the authors of the Don't Bank on the Bomb report. The latest one's just been published. But before we talk about that, can you tell us a bit about the history of the report?
Sure. So ICANN has been publishing these reports and in conjunction with PACS for the better part of the last decade, actually since 2012. And we did it because we wanted to illustrate who is behind nuclear weapons and how do they make money, and start talking about the bankers and the pension funds as a way to give people a space to get active on the issue that was different than a political path.
So what's the role of the report in the overall divestment campaign work?
So this report, the one that's coming out now, it talks about who are the banks, the pension funds that are still actively connected to the production of nuclear weapons through their investments, through the loans and the financing. And in order to be able to challenge these investors, we need to know who they are. So the report helps give us that background bit of information to move the issue forward and to have these conversations and give these investors a chance to do better.
But there's a lot more in this report, isn't there, than just a list of investors. What are the main findings in this year's report?
So what this year's report shows are the investors, and there's 287 investors that are identified. They could be stockholders, bondholders, or financiers, those who offer loans or underwrite shareholding and bondholding, share insurances and bond issuance. And the report also talks about the companies that they invest in, the companies that are connected to the nuclear weapons industry. So it talks about 24 main companies that produce the key components necessary for nuclear weapons. So these are components. It's not who builds the hammer to put the things together, but these are actually the specifically designed components for nuclear weapons that contribute to their overall lethality. So it's the companies that build the bomb and those who profit from investing in them that are detailed in this report.
And it's not just the United States that it covers, is it?
Absolutely not. The companies come up from China, Russia, the United States, India, the United Kingdom and France. Those are the arsenals that they work on. Some of the companies that work on these arsenals are not in nuclear armed states. So we have companies like Airbus that builds parts for the French nuclear arsenal, and Airbus is a Dutch company, or Leonardo that builds parts also for the French nuclear arsenal, and that's an Italian company. And of course, BAE Systems that profits off of everybody because they build parts for both the US, UK, and the French arsenals. They're taking it in from all sides.
So what is the main trend that we're seeing then over the past few years? Are we seeing more companies, more institutions investing, fewer institutions investing, more money being invested, less money being invested? How does it appear at the moment?
Well, I'll be honest with you. It really surprised me that we've actually seen two companies that were heavily involved in the nuclear weapons industry drop out. And both of them cited concerns with being able to be investable from an environmental social governance perspective. So two companies have stopped their engagement and their role in the production of nuclear weapons because of pressure from financiers. And since the nuclear ban treaty went into effect, every year the number of investors has gone down and down and down. And that's a very positive trend, I think, because it shows very clearly that the ban treaty is having an impact, even in countries that aren't yet on board, and that the issue of nuclear weapons is something that's really untouchable. And I think that's important, that we can show from all sides of society a rejection of nuclear weapons.
That was Alistair Burnett, ICANN's head of media, and Susie Snyder, program coordinator for the organization. We will link to the report jointly issued by ICANN and PAX, Untenable Investments, showing that the number of investors supporting the nuclear weapons industry decreased for the third year in a row. The number of financial institutions with significant investments in companies involved in producing nuclear weapons fell from 306 to 287 in 2023. We will link to the Untenable Investments report on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 662. The ICANN update is now a monthly feature of Nuclear Hot Seat and will bring you the cutting-edge information and what's being done to, as the name says, abolish nuclear weapons through the United Nations Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. We are honored to have them on board. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, I know that you care about getting honest nuclear news, and that's what we set out to provide here at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Verifiable nuclear information that's been sourced, checked, footnoted, and vetted, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on different aspects of the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you about people on the front lines of activism around the world, their triumphs, challenges, and how you can help them. We get underneath the manicured exterior of mainstream media's nuclear stories to provide context and continuity because we want you to understand what the issues are, what we are up against, and what any of us can do about it. So here's one thing you can do about it. We run on donations, and right now our expenses far outstrip the monies we've been sent. This show cannot survive without your support, yours. So if you're grateful for the information you get from this show, now is the time to help us out. Be it a one-time donation of any amount or a monthly recurring donation, you'll be supporting all the services required to keep this program up and running. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 not-for-profit organization, which means that your donation is tax-deductible. And we make it easy for you to help us out. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and follow the prompts. Or if you have Zelle, you can send directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large. So don't wait. We need your help now. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, donate, and help keep our nuclear news online. Whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Every year, the Nuclear Weapons Military Industrial Complex gathers in D.C. to party down for 3 days of glad-handing, reinforcement of their justifications, promotion of their products, and a bit of nudge-nudge, wink-wink lobbying for billions of dollars in what's called arms control. According to the 2024 National Nuclear Deterrence Summit's press materials, attendees would be treated to industry and government experts who inspire, present updates, and discuss business opportunities that participants will be able to act on. We wonder where they get their agenda. The 2024 summit, just concluded January 31st to February 2nd, included speakers from the National Nuclear Security Agency, the U.S. House of Representatives, the U.S. Senate, National Laboratories, the U.S. Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Defense, contractors, and more. Our tax dollars at work, or being squandered. It truly is the belly of the beast. So what's a veteran activist against nukes doing there? That's what we're about to find out. Greg Mello is a founder and the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, with more than 30 years' experience opposing nukes. He recently returned from a three-day trip to the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit in D.C., where those responsible for the worst aspects of our nuclear future gathered to network, self-promote, self-justify, put dibs in on massive amounts of government monies, and party down with others who believe just the same as they do. Greg provides a ton of insights and analysis, and there are a lot of jaw drops during this interview. So listen up to learn what we are genuinely up against. I spoke with Greg Mello on February 16, 2024. Greg Mello, thanks so much for joining us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby.
Refresh our memory. What is the Los Alamos Study Group and what is your position within it?
The Los Alamos Study Group is a disarmament-related think tank in Albuquerque. We do advocacy, we do research, we train young persons when we can. We are now doing a little organizing. We do some litigation, and we are interested in peace, and we are interested in nuclear disarmament, and we are interested in a livable culture and sustainable environment. All these things bear on the nuclear issue here in New Mexico and nationally, and I am the chief cook and bottle washer here, and my wife, who is behind me working, is my partner in crime.
Well, partner in trying to undo the nuclear crimes.
Yes.
Recently, you attended something that we have both characterized as being in the belly of the beast. What was the event and who usually attends and why?
This was the annual Nuclear Deterrence Summit, which is organized by the Nuclear Weapons Trade Press, and it involves contractors, government officials, a few reporters, a few activists, a couple activists, one posing as a reporter, and I think I was the only actual NGO under open cover. There were 600 or more people there. The contractors use it to network, to hire each other's staff away, to figure out what are the current buzzwords and phrases that they need to get contracts. And everyone can look at what's happened in the past year, trade experience, lessons learned, encourage each other, solidify the contractor block, and move forward into an ever more prosperous coming year.
Is this one of those conferences that actually has like a marketplace booth area?
Yes, absolutely. I have pictures. There were tons of booths, you know, Bechtel, Raytheon, Parsons. The nuclear warhead business has a somewhat special group of Beltway bandits that do most of the work. And so they pretty much mostly represented there, along with some new entries, Amazon Web Services, I hadn't seen them before, Boston Government Services, lots of people, because this is a growth industry.
How many days does this last, and what kind of materials are covered, either in general sessions or in breakout sessions?
This is a conference without formal breakout sessions. Everything is in plenary. The things that were discussed are the strategic environment, what policy is and should be, the regulatory environment, which is very thin, reports from the production plants, reports from the national labs, particular issues like best practices in construction, because there's a lot of construction problems, that sort of thing.
Is the government, is the Department of Energy, Department of Defense, are they represented at this as well, either in the audience or from the stage?
Both. There was the head of the Strategic Command, which has nuclear weapons, has all the nuclear weapons that are deployed and in reserve. He spoke. General Cotton, Assistant Secretary of State for Arms Control, spoke. The head of the National Nuclear Security Administration, which is part of the Department of Energy that works on nuclear weapons and nuclear nonproliferation and the design of nuclear reactors for the Navy, she spoke and her deputy spoke, and their deputies spoke on more specific topics. The GAO was there, and the Defense Nuclear Facilities Safety Board was there. Various people in different parts of the revolving door between congressional staff and lobbyist identities. But current congressional staff, it was a little thin on the ground. Now, the Pentagon was there, the head of the nuclear matters at the Pentagon, but Congress was poorly represented there. So that was a little interesting. Now, that's because there's almost no oversight of the nuclear weapons industry going on right now.
So this was a weaving together of what sounds like a pretty unified perspective coming from both the industry and the government at the same time. Would that be accurate?
Part of the government. You could say this was the visible part of the nuclear deep state. I would say that there were three levels of policy that were presented. The first you might call the program of record. I mean, that's what it is called. So that's what Congress has already approved. And the NNSA and its contractors and DOD are trying to implement that. So they get money for that and they're trying to implement it, the program of record. That now includes seven types of warheads and bombs that they're working on, more than any since the Reagan administration, plus new subs, plus one new bomber and an upgrade of the old B-52s, new ICBMs, new fighter bombers that drop nuclear bombs, those with dual capable aircraft, a new cruise missile, the long-range standoff weapon, an upgrade of the Trident missile. Congress has demanded that the administration work on the sea-launched cruise missile nuclear. The Navy has been reluctant, but that's now part of the program of record, plus all the maintenance, plus the current deployment, plus the factories to make all this. All of this is over budget, and it really exceeds the current capacity available in the NNSA's workforce, which is now 60,000, with a total industrial base of about 200,000 or 300,000 altogether, including the suppliers. That would be the program of record. That is a greater than $2 trillion endeavor over 30 years, and everything is a little bit spiraling out of control, but that reality was largely suppressed. Then the second level, but that's not enough for many people. So there was a special panel for the America's Strategic Posture, a final report of the Congressional Commission on the Strategic Posture of the United States. This is a report commissioned by Congress to study all the additional steps which should be done to get ready for a nuclear confrontation, not just with Russia, but also with China. So this has other elements. Basically, they amount to an urgent qualitative and quantitative increase in the nuclear arsenal and a speed up of the schedule and integration with space assets and other elements of the military. The third level, which was even more little shocking, but that wasn't emphasized, might be called massive nuclear rearmament. That would be all the above, plus more plutonium warhead triggers, pits, more tritium to put inside of them, stop disposing of surplus plutonium or even thinking about it, use the thousands of existing older pits in a massive new development of tactical mini nukes to be able to use in theater wars, plus hypersonic delivered nuclear weapons, which are just a dream at this point in the United States, and expanding the basing of these hypersonic weapons to include Germany and also start basing them in the Indo-Pacific. All of that was one speaker was advocating that, but I think it was in the background for many others. So it makes the program of record look very modest in comparison.
That's quite the list. And for me, it raises an existential question. Are we as a country, if not we as a planet, owned by the nuclear industry?
We as a country are currently owned by the nuclear weapons industry to the extent they have the capacity to absorb money. I mean, you can answer that question in the same tripartite way. The program of record does not refer explicitly to owning the government. America's Strategic Posture Report, which is right here, does refer explicitly to making this a whole of government effort. That is a major thrust. They don't want anybody saying no to any part of this. The speech by General Cotton of Strategic Command went a step further. He wants a whole of the nation effort. That involves the wholesale training of our young people for jobs to produce all this because we can't. We just don't have the skilled people to make all these nuclear weapon and delivery systems. So it requires a whole of nation effort. So that's the level of ambition that you see. And it's a symptom of the lack of pushback from responsible members of Congress. Well, maybe that's a oxymoron.
I was about to say responsible member of Congress. That's a contradiction in terms.
Now, there was a voice or two that said, we're not going to get all of this. So the chief of staff of Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory said, I don't think we're going to get all of this. Privately, one of the participants in the, who's a government employee, I said, don't we have a debt crisis? And aren't we paying an enormous amount and rising exponentially on the interest on this debt? And how will that play into all these grand plans? And she said, they're going to have, right with you, they're going to have to pick. They can't do all this. So there was, you know, the voices of reality were there, but they were largely muted in the background.
What did you go there hoping to achieve other than gaining this information? Do you think there was any ability to have influence, to have your voice heard, to maybe be sought out by others who wanted to talk at your level?
It was a disappointing conference in some ways, because they've moved now so far to the right that the effort to break through the blaring narratives is much more difficult. It was larger and it was farther to the right than they've been, and it had less actual information. So one of the reasons to go is to glean information, know thine enemy. And another is to show the flag and remind them that there's opposition. A third, which used to be operative, but I didn't really, it's not anymore, is there might be allies that could help us. Well, it was, there was that. So there were government people, and it was efficient to have meetings with people over hors d'oeuvres or over breakfast. You could talk to people that otherwise you have to schedule appointments, and it's fairly chancy some of the time.
What was your best or most hopeful experience during this conference? Was there one?
Let me think a second. My best experience was probably listening to a panel of people who are building things and hearing how they were overcoming the problems that we have in the United States in actually accomplishing anything in the physical world. So I have a weakness for people who know how to do things and get stuff done and build a corporate culture that is able to do that despite obstacles. We don't often see it. And there are lessons learned for the nonprofit community in listening to these people about how to retain staff, how to build a sense of belonging and engagement. I enjoyed listening to that particular panel. I can't say I enjoyed any other panel. Perhaps the best moments occurred when hostile questions came from the press. The GIO asked a probing question or two.
Did you have a chance to ask any questions?
I did. I asked as many as possible, as usual. But with 600 people, it's harder to break through. I think I asked more questions than anybody else, but that still wasn't too many. The participation level in the conference was lower and the orchestration level was higher. And I think it was partly a function of just the size as well as the, there was a change from the previous year. The previous year, the participants spoke a great deal about their problems, which is very useful to understand. This year, it seemed like they had made a pact, the conference organizers. We're not going to talk about the problems. We're going to talk about how great we are. And that makes it boring a little bit.
To say nothing of self-serving. On the flip side of this, what did you find most ominous or most depressing or upsetting about the information you were learning?
You have to understand that this is a mental health challenge. And I hated it. And it was more than it ever has been, probably, because the conference was solidified on the far nuclear right, you might say, between these three levels of hawkishness, with very hawkish to ultra hawkish. I felt that when the Assistant Secretary of State was speaking, I was a little bit fascinated as well as repelled, because of the level of weaponization of her entire personality and the completeness that she had given herself over to providing the intellectual support for warmongering. And her job was arms control and diplomacy. But there wasn't a diplomatic bone in her body. And to hear her go on and on in an intelligent way about the evil Russia, she was speaking to, of course, a friendly audience, and to hear pretty much from many of the most senior speakers, enormous ignorance about the state of the world. So these are people who get intelligence briefings, who are, I mean, General Cotton at Stratcom. He doesn't understand recent history. He doesn't understand anything about U.S.-Russian relations, about the war in Ukraine. They're all looking at this through a very blinkered and warped perspective that precludes arms control and disarmament. So it's not like they're trying and want to go to Los Angeles, but they're heading towards San Francisco. They're never going to get there.
That was depressing. In your time there, was there any sense of joining together with the few others who you knew were opposed to it? And if so, what was that like other than commiseration and crying on each other's shoulders?
So we had a wonderful dinner, five of us. That would be some of the dissidents who were there and outside. There were people outside holding signs. We all got together for dinner and traded stories. And from that little beginning, I think that nice things are happening already because of that. That could grow. The conference itself is a desert.
There was no one from the conference, from that side of the fence, who reached out to you in a covert way as maybe becoming a whistleblower kind of a person?
No, that would have been nice. One of the depressing parts of this is that as Washington, D.C. has moved toward what I would describe as a war psychosis, it has swept up some of the people who 15 years ago, 10 years ago, were kind of quasi-allies or frenemies. It becomes harder to function in official Washington without going along with the pack. And so I saw some of that, and that was really depressing.
In your time there, do you feel that you had the opportunity to plant any seeds of sanity or throw sand into the mechanism that was there to maybe slow down the insanity?
I learned the overall background is valuable. It informs everything we do here. So we are not going to rush out there with some kind of blind optimism about the state of our government and depend on reform through a liberal democratic means, which would be the default position of most people my age. So that's helpful. And there was some, I can tick off a few of the important insights that I did get. There was the claim that the United States does not target cities. And there was underlying it all the notion that a nuclear war can be fought and can be won. So many people in the NGO community believe that nuclear war is not something we can ever fight or win. President Biden, President Putin reaffirmed this. But at the operative level and the planning level, a different set of assumptions apply.
And when they say they believe that they can win a nuclear war, how do they define win?
Well, I'm sort of simplifying. They call it escalation management or escalation control, or you had a quote here. Someone said, how will the U.S. control this situation? The idea is that integrating the various aspects of U.S. military power, situations can be coerced so that the U.S. comes out ahead. But part of that is the understanding by the opposing force that we have escalation dominance and we can't be pushed around as a result. That was pretty clear throughout the whole thing. Another thing that I think that many people didn't really know is that we now are facing the phrases are two peer adversaries or a unified adversary. In other words, China is not an included case in the nuclear business. We must increase the nuclear arsenal so that we can target the Chinese nuclear forces and China in general. It is expected to be, by 10 years from now, a lot of targets. So this is driving the nuclear weapons business.
So you are in Albuquerque, which is another belly of the beast, where nuclear pit production is being escalated to keep up with this demand for 10 years from now, we need to be able to target
China.
I know Los Alamos Study Group has been very active in pushing back against this. What is the latest?
The latest is that Los Alamos is not making any pits. They may make a single pit this calendar year. They're making practice pits right now.
Practice pits that don't have plutonium in them.
No, they do, but they're not of high quality. They have defects.
I see a 99-cent store with cut-rate nuclear bombs in it.
Yeah, so they melt them down, and they hope to achieve their first, as they call it, diamond-stamped pit by the end of this calendar year, which the Livermore Weapons Director said would be a major milestone for the entire nuclear weapons complex. But the installation of all the equipment will take many years to come. So making one is a start, but they don't expect to finish installation of the equipment to make 30 pits per year reliably until 2032. The other pit factory in South Carolina, which is being built in a facility which is new, but originally built for another purpose, is not finished, is still in the retooling stage. They are cutting internal walls to make it possible to put a production line in rooms that there are like 600 rooms in this facility. And They're making a number of cuts through the walls to connect those rooms. They have started site work over there. That one will take longer. They expect, optimistically, to be in production by 2035. That's a larger facility. It is perhaps 5 times larger than the one at Los Alamos, which is way too small. The only way Los Alamos can do this is by working 24/7. So pit production is by no means settled, and this causes a kind of panic in the strategic circles. And then there are problems elsewhere, for example, in Oak Ridge with the uranium processing facility, which is years behind and billions overpriced. So pit production is slowly, if you talk to them, they're just great. Everything's really great. But actually, it's a long way from happening.
Well, I guess the good news is that we won't have quite as many bombs and won't be able to blow up the planet X number of times in addition to the number of times we already can.
Right. Except we're keeping all the, pretty much all the old warheads.
What can we do? What can be done? Is there a way that people listening to this interview can take an action, even a small single action, that would help us move towards us not going over this cliff of let's make more bombs and use up all the money that the country's got so that we can blow up everything?
Mm-hmm. Something very practical. And it sounds self-serving, but when you sit where we do in the middle of the world capital of weapons of mass destruction here in New Mexico, almost half of the warhead budget is spent in the state. You know, there's a lab over there to the south. There's a lab to the north. Those are the two largest labs by dollars in the whole world. Los Alamos National Lab, the largest by dollars in the world, and Sandia National Laboratories, Albuquerque main branch. So we have something on our website called Call for Sanity, Not Nuclear Production. If you go to lasg.org, you will see it there. We would really love for people to endorse that. There's a very simple form. It's a very simple call, especially if you are with a nonprofit organization or a religious organization. We have a list of those who have already endorsed this. We are at the risk of being completely submerged and taken over by the nuclear, by these contractors. And the reason why it's so important is that without these new pits from Los Alamos, which will be in production 10 years earlier than Savannah River, we can't have an arms race in the United States. So they need the pits in order to make the warheads for any new weapon, specifically for the new ICBM system called Sentinel, which is being developed, but 450 missile silos have to be upgraded. It will be capital cost of all the missiles and the silos about $150 billion. But they don't yield new warheads for the system without Los Alamos production. One of the little facts that was stated at this conference was that the Savannah River site won't be making pits for the system. They'll be making pits for another system when it eventually comes online. So for the ICBMs, the very controversial Sentinel system, they are entirely dependent for their new warheads on Los Alamos pits. Some people think, well, we could reuse old pits. Not really, because every missile has a unique warhead. Every warhead, the pit is tailored to the warhead, the warhead's tailored to the missile, and the pits aren't new. So they aren't going to put old pits on a new missile. So it's very important to inject reality into this system. The reality that this is not going to be a whole of nation or whole of government endeavor. We need to back off and start cooperating with other countries and not have an arms race. That's the first thing I would say. Just please, if you can, endorse the call for sanity. It says, we don't want pit production anywhere, but first and foremost, at Los Alamos. That's the first thing. Then the next is that I think we have to try to understand our so-called nuclear adversaries. Russophobia is the fuel of the nuclear arms race. We never had it during, for the last 20 years, and even during the Cold War, there was a respect for the adversary that we do not have. It has almost become a kind of racism. And I urge everyone to listen to the Tucker Carlson interview with Vladimir Putin. There'll be no nuclear disarmament without a rapprochement with Russia first, and then with China, which is quite absurd that we would be planning to be at war with China when we are so dependent on China in so many different ways. That relationship has not deteriorated quite as far as the one with Russia. So that's the second thing. Do whatever you can to learn, try to understand in your circles. The overarching thing is to realize that this is not going to change without serious resistance. We have quite a bit of it. We have very talented leaders around the country. Some are in religious organizations, some are humanists, some are just folks that can't stand the idea of blowing up the planet.
That would be me.
We need to build local resistance and not imagine that, oh, we just elect this person or that person, it's going to change everything. If we just write our congressmen, let me tell you, it's way, way, way beyond that. The government is captive to the military, industrial, academic, media, think tank, intelligence complex. And without committed, organized, firm opposition, they will march forward and they will march right over us. We can ground this opposition in a constructive program involving building a sustainable communities, in community service, and in mutual aid. And we can found a broader resistance and resilience movement that will inspire candidates all over the political spectrum. And of course, this doesn't rule out running for office also. But just don't think that voting for this person or that person is some form of activism that's going to matter.
We will, of course, link on the website to what you call the Registry of Resistance, where people can make their voices known in opposition to the building of pits. I have one last question for you.
Yes.
How do you sleep at night?
We have friends. And we find solace in the companionship of friends new and old. We make a decision that this takes effort, but that we've done as much as we can today, and we will save the rest for tomorrow. And even so, that's still sometimes difficult to get exercise. Take care of yourself, because this is a marathon. But seriously, the U.S. is headed for a political crisis. And we might as well be active and face things courageously, because otherwise we'll be the victim of despair, depression. We need to connect with others and address all of this head on, or we'll just be victims.
Which, of course, is not on the agenda for either one of us or so many of the people we know and who listen to this show. Greg Mello, you have my appreciation for being willing to go where you go and deal with the material that you deal with, and to do so steadfastly. And I want to thank you for bringing us up to date and being with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much, Libby.
That was Greg Mello. He is one of the founders and the executive director of the Los Alamos Study Group, based in Albuquerque, New Mexico. On the website, we will have a link up to the Los Alamos Study Group's Call for Sanity, Not Nuclear Production. That makes it easy for you to find, and we ask that you do find it and that you sign on. It's at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 662.
Activists, shout out.
Christopher Nolan, director of the film Oppenheimer, is sweeping up movie industry awards for his flawed yet important film, Oppenheimer. He and the film have been criticized for leaving out any mention of the people who lived in proximity to the nuclear blast at Trinity in New Mexico, and also for not showing any of the damage on the ground in Japan. Still, he seems to have heard at least some of the criticisms leveled against him, and at his acceptance speech for Best Director at the BAFTA, British Academy of Film and Television Arts Awards, he had this to say.
But in the real world, there are all kinds of individuals and organizations who have fought long and hard to reduce the number of nuclear weapons in the world. And since its peak in 1967, they've done it by almost 90%. Of late, that's gone the wrong way. And so in accepting this, I do just want to acknowledge their efforts and point out that they show the necessity and the potential of efforts for peace.
Thanks, Chris. It doesn't make up for your omissions from the film, but it's better than a kick in the pants. And Carl Grossman, veteran environmental journalist based on Long Island, and my own personal Eminence Grease, Great Gray Eminence, has been commemorated in an editorial cartoon on endangered species. And one of those endangered species is local newspapers and journalism. Carl shows up as the face of local journalism, which is definitely an endangered species. The cartoon appeared in several Long Island newspapers, and it will be included on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 662. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, February 27, 2024. Hey, do you sometimes miss an episode of Nuclear Hot Seat? That doesn't have to be the case, and we make it easy. You can get the show delivered every week either by subscribing on your favorite podcast channel or cut to the chase. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com. There's a big honking yellow opt-in box that you really can't miss that'll just pop up right in your face. Put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one email, just one, with the link and a short description of the show's content. That way, you'll have no problem keeping up with the show and hearing the news on nuclear issues every week. A lot of this show is sourced from information that people send along to me. So if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help and will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Nuclear Hot Seat, and Hartestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, and throw in a couple of names, including mine, if you have a chance. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, at the heart of nuclear risk lies the flawed, unproven, and dangerous theory of nuclear deterrence. It's mutually assured destruction, or MAD, as the initials have us call it, and it is indeed madness. There you've got it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because let's face it, we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.